There was not a gun in the place. There were knives hanging from the magnetized runners in the kitchen, but Jack was between her and them. In her striving to make the right decision, to find the alternative, the bitter irony of her thoughts did not occur. An hour ago she had been asleep, firmly convinced that things were all right and soon would be even better. Now she was considering the possibility of using a butcher knife on her husband if he tried to interfere with her and her son. At last she stood up with Danny in her arms, her legs trembling. There was no other way. She would have to assume that Jack awake was Jack sane, and that he would help her get Danny down to Sidewinder and Dr. Edmonds. And if Jack tried to do anything but help, God help him. She went to the door and unlocked it. Shifting Danny up to her shoulder, she opened it and went out into the hall. "Jack?" she called nervously, and got no answer. With growing trepidation, she walked down to the stairwell, but Jack was not there. And as she stood there on the landing, wondering what to do next, the singing came up from below, rich, angry, bitterly satiric. "Roll me over in the clover. Roll me over, lay me down, and do it again." She was frightened even more by the sound of him than she had been by his silence, but there was still no alternative. She started down the stairs. 28. It was her. Jack had stood on the stairs, listening to the crooning, comforting sounds coming muffled through the locked door, and slowly his confusion had given way to anger. Things had never really changed, not to Wendy. He could be off the juice for 20 years, and still when he came home at night and she embraced him at the door, he would sense that little flare of her nostrils as she tried to divine scotch or gin fumes riding the outbound train of his exhalation. She was always going to assume the worst. If he and Danny got in a car accident with a drunken blind man who had had a stroke just before the collision, she would silently blame Danny's injuries on him and turn away. Her face, as she had snatched Danny away, it rose up before him, and he suddenly wanted to wipe the anger that had been on it out with his fist. She had no goddamn right. Yes, maybe at first. He had been a lush. He had done terrible things. Breaking Danny's arm had been a terrible thing. But if a man reforms, doesn't he deserve to have his reformation credited sooner or later? And if he doesn't get it, doesn't he deserve the game to go with the name? If a father constantly accuses his virginal daughter of screwing every boy in junior high, must she not at last grow weary enough of it to earn her scoldings? And if a wife secretly and not so secretly continues to believe that her teetotaling husband is a drunk? He got up, walked slowly down to the first floor landing, and stood there for a moment. He took his handkerchief from his back pocket, wiped his lips with it, and considered going down and pounding on the bedroom door, demanding to be let in so he could see his son. She had no right to be so goddamn high-handed. Well, sooner or later she'd have to come out, unless she planned a radical sort of diet for the two of them. A rather ugly grin touched his lips at the thought. Let her come to him. She would in time. He went downstairs to the ground floor, stood aimlessly by the lobby desk for a moment, then turned right. He went into the dining room and stood just inside the door. The empty tables, their white linen cloths neatly cleaned and pressed beneath their clear plastic covers, glimmered up at him. All was deserted now, but dinner will be served at 8 p.m., unmasking and dancing at midnight. Jack walked among the tables, momentarily forgetting his wife and son upstairs, forgetting the dream, the smashed radio, the bruises. He trailed his fingers over the slick plastic dust covers, trying to imagine how it must have been on that hot August night in 1945. The war won, the future stretching ahead so various and new, like a land of dreams. The bright and party-colored Japanese lanterns hung the whole length of the circular drive, the golden yellow light spilling from these high windows that were now drifted over with snow. Men and women in costume, here a glittering princess, there a high-booted cavalier, flashing jewelry and flashing wit everywhere, dancing, liquor flowing freely, First wine and then cocktails, and then perhaps Boilermakers. The level of conversation going up and up and up, until the jolly cry rang out from the bandmaster's podium, the cry of, "Unmask! Unmask!" And the Red Death held sway. He found himself standing on the other side of the dining room, just outside the stylized batwing doors of the Colorado Lounge, where on that night in 1945, all the booze would have been free. "Belly up to the bar, partner. The drinks are on the house." He stepped through the batwings and into the deep, folded shadows of the bar. And a strange thing occurred. He had been in here before, once to check the inventory sheet Ullman had left, and he knew the place had been stripped clean. The shelves were totally bare. But now, lit only murkily by the light which filtered through from the dining room, which was itself only dimly lit because of the snow blocking the windows, he thought he saw ranks and ranks of bottles twinkling mutedly behind the bar, and siphons, and even beer dripping from the spigots of all three highly polished taps. Yes, he could even smell beer, that damp and fermented and yeasty odor, no different from the smell that had hung finely misted around his father's face every night when he came home from work. Eyes widening, he fumbled for the wall switch, and the low, intimate bar lighting came on. Circles of 20-watt bulbs implanted on the tops of the three wagon-wheel chandeliers overhead. The shelves were all empty. They had not even as yet gathered a good coat of dust. The beer taps were dry, as were the chrome drains beneath them. To his left and right, the velvet-upholstered booths stood like men with high backs, each one designed to give a maximum of privacy to the couple inside. Straight ahead, across the red-carpeted floor, 40 bar stools stood around the horseshoe-shaped bar. Each stool was upholstered in leather and embossed with cattle brands. Circle H, Bar D Bar, that was fitting, Rocking W, Lazy B. He approached it, giving his head a little shake of bewilderment as he did so. It was like that day on the playground when, but there was no sense in thinking about that. Still, he could have sworn he had seen those bottles vaguely, it was true. The way you see the darkened shapes of furniture in a room where the curtains have been drawn. Mild glints on glass. The only thing that remained was that smell of beer, and Jack knew that was a smell that faded into the woodwork of every bar in the world after a certain period of time, not to be eradicated by any cleaner invented. Yet the smell here seemed sharp. Almost fresh. He sat down on one of the stools and propped his elbows on the bar's leather-cushioned edge. At his left hand was a bowl for peanuts, now empty, of course. The first bar he'd been in for 19 months, and the damned thing was dry. Just his luck. All the same, a bitterly powerful wave of nostalgia swept over him, and the physical craving for a drink seemed to work itself up from his belly to his throat to his mouth and nose, shriveling and wrinkling the tissues as it went, making them cry out for something wet and long and cold. He glanced at the shelves again in wild, irrational hope, but the shelves were just as empty as before. He grinned in pain and frustration. His fists, clenching slowly, made minute scratchings on the bar's leather-padded edge. "Hi, Lloyd," he said. "A little slow tonight, isn't it?" Lloyd said it was. Lloyd asked him what it would be. "Now I'm really glad you asked me that," Jack said. "Really glad. Because I happen to have 2 20s and 2 10s in my wallet, and I was afraid they'd be sitting there until sometime next April. There isn't a 7-Eleven around here, would you believe it? And I thought they had 7-Elevens on the fucking moon." Lloyd sympathized. "So here's what," Jack said. "You set me up an even 20 martinis. An even 20, just like that, kazang. One for every month I've been on the wagon, and one to grow on. You can do that, can't you? You aren't too busy." Lloyd said he wasn't busy at all. "Good man. You line those Martians up right along the bar, and I'm going to take them down, one by one. White man's burden, Lloyd, my man." Lloyd turned to do the job. Jack reached into his pocket for his money clip and came out with an Excedrin bottle instead. His money clip was on the bedroom bureau, and of course his skinny Shank's wife had locked him out of the bedroom. "Nice going, Wendy, you bleeding bitch." I seem to be momentarily light, Jack said. How's my credit in this joint, anyhow? Lloyd said his credit was fine. That's super. I like you, Lloyd. You were always the best of them. Best damn barkeep between Barry and Portland, Maine. Portland, Oregon, for that matter. Lloyd thanked him for saying so. Jack thumped the cap from his Excedrin bottle, shook two tablets out, and flipped them into his mouth. The familiar acid-compelling taste flooded in. He had a sudden sensation that people were watching him, curiously and with some contempt. The booths behind him were full. There were graying, distinguished men and beautiful young girls, all of them in costume, watching this sad exercise in the dramatic arts with cold amusement. Jack whirled on his stool. The booths were all empty, stretching away from the lounge door to the left and right, the line on his left cornering to flank the bar's horseshoe curve down the short length of the room. Padded leather seats and backs, gleaming dark formica tables, an ashtray on each one, a book of matches in each ashtray, the words Colorado Lounge stamped on each in gold leaf above the batwing door logo. He turned back, swallowing the rest of the dissolving Excedrin with a grimace. Lloyd, you're a wonder, he said. Set up already. Your speed is only exceeded by the soulful beauty of your Neapolitan eyes. Salud. Jack contemplated the 20 imaginary drinks, the martini glasses blushing droplets of condensation, each with a swizzle poked through a plump green olive. He could almost smell gin on the air. The wagon, he said. Have you ever been acquainted with a gentleman who has hopped up on the wagon? Lloyd allowed as how he had met such men from time to time. Have you ever renewed acquaintances with such a man after he hopped back off? Lloyd could not, in all honesty, recall. You never did, then, Jack said. He curled his hand around the first drink, carried his fist to his mouth, which was open, and turned his fist up. He swallowed, and then tossed the imaginary glass over his shoulder. The people were back again, fresh from their costume ball, studying him, laughing behind their hands. He could feel them. If the back bar had featured a mirror instead of those damn stupid empty shelves, he could have seen them. Let them stare. Fuck them. Let anybody stare who wanted to stare. No, you never did, he told Lloyd. Few men ever return from the fabled wagon, but those who do come with a fearful tale to tell. When you jump on, it seems like the brightest, cleanest wagon you ever saw, with 10-foot wheels to keep the bed of it high out of the gutter where all the drunks are laying around with their brown bags and their Thunderbird and their Granddad Flash's Popskull bourbon. You're away from all the people who throw you nasty looks and tell you to clean up your act or go put it on in another town. From the gutter, that's the finest-looking wagon you ever saw, Lloyd, my boy. All hung with bunting and a brass band in front, and three majorettes to each side, twirling their batons and flashing their panties at you. Man, you gotta get on that wagon and away from the juicers that are straining canned heat and smelling their own puke to get high again and poking along the gutter for butts with half an inch left below the filter. He drained two more imaginary drinks and tossed the glasses back over his shoulder. He could almost hear them smashing on the floor. And goddamn if he wasn't starting to feel high. It was the Excedrin. So you climb up, he told Lloyd, and ain't you glad to be there? My God, yes, that's affirmative. That wagon is the biggest and best float in the whole parade, and everybody is lining the streets and clapping and cheering and waving, all for you. Except for the winos passed out in the gutter. Those guys used to be your friends, but that's all behind you now. He carried his empty fist to his mouth and sluiced down another, four down, 16 to go, making excellent progress. He swayed a little on the stool. Let him stare if that was how they got off. Take a picture, folks. It'll last longer. Then you start to see things, Lloydy, my boy. Things you missed from the gutter. Like how the floor of the wagon is nothing but straight pine boards, so fresh they're still bleeding sap, and if you took your shoes off, you'd be sure to get a splinter. Like how the only furniture in the wagon is these long benches with high backs and no cushions to sit on, and in fact they are nothing but pews with a songbook every 5 feet or so. Like how all the people sitting in the pews on the wagon are these flat-chested Albertos in long dresses with a little lace around the collar and their hair pulled back into buns until it's so tight you can almost hear it screaming. And every face is flat and pale and shiny, and they're all singing, "Shall we gather at the river? The beautiful, the river." And up front there's this reeking bitch with blonde hair playing the organ and telling them to sing louder, and somebody slams a songbook into your hands and says, "Sing it out, brother. If you expect to stay on this wagon, you got to sing morning, noon, and night, especially at night." And that's when you realize what the wagon really is, Lloyd. It's a church with bars on the windows, a church for women, and a prison for you. He stopped. Lloyd was gone. Worse still, he had never been there. The drinks had never been there. Only the people in the booths, the people from the costume party. And he could almost hear their muffled laughter as they held their hands to their mouths and pointed, their eyes sparkling with cruel pinpoints of light. He whirled around again. "Leave me!" "Alone?" All the booths were empty. The sound of laughter had died like a stir of autumn leaves. Jack stared at the empty lounge for a tick of time, his eyes wide and dark. A pulse beat noticeably in the center of his forehead. In the very center of him, a cold certainty was forming, and the certainty was that he was losing his mind. He felt an urge to pick up the bar stool next to him, reverse it, and go through the place like an avenging whirlwind. Instead, he whirled back around to the bar and began to bellow, "Roll me over in the clover. Roll me over, lay me down, and do it again." Danny's face rose before him. Not Danny's normal face, lively and alert, the eyes sparkling and open, but the catatonic, zombie-like face of a stranger, the eyes dull and opaque, the mouth pursed babyishly around his thumb. What was he doing? Sitting here and talking to himself like a sulky teenager when his son was upstairs, someplace, acting like something that belonged in a padded room, acting the way Wally Hollis said Vic Stenger had been before the men in the white coats had to come and take him away. "But I never put a hand on him. God damn it, I didn't." "Jack?" The voice was timid, hesitant. He was so startled he almost fell off the stool, whirling it around. Wendy was standing just inside the batwing doors, Danny cradled in her arms like some waxen horror show dummy. The three of them made a tableau that Jack felt very strongly. It was just before the curtain of Act Two in some old-time temperance play, one so poorly mounted that the prop man had forgotten to stock the shelves of the Den of Iniquity. "I never touched him," Jack said thickly. "I never have since the night I broke his arm. Not even to spank him." "Jack, that doesn't matter now. What matters is—" "This matters!" he shouted. He brought one fist crashing down on the bar, hard enough to make the empty peanut dishes jump. "It matters, goddammit! It matters!" "Jack, we have to get him off the mountain. He's—" Danny began to stir in her arms. The slack, empty expression on his face had begun to break up like a thick mat of ice over some buried surface. His lips twisted, as if at some weird taste. His eyes widened. His hands came up as if to cover them, and then dropped back. Abruptly, he stiffened in her arms. His back arched into a bow, making Wendy stagger, and he suddenly began to shriek, mad sounds that escaped his straining throat in bolt after crazy, echoing bolt. The sound seemed to fill the empty downstairs and come back at them like banshees. There might have been 100 Dannys, all screaming at once. "Jack!" she cried in terror. "Oh, God! Jack, what's wrong with him?" He came off the stool, numb from the waist down, more frightened than he had ever been in his life. What hole had his son poked through and into? What dark nest? And what had been in there to sting him? "Danny!" he roared. "Danny!" Danny saw him. He broke his mother's grip with a sudden, fierce strength that gave her no chance to hold him. She stumbled back against one of the booths and nearly fell into it. "Daddy!" he screamed, running to Jack, his eyes huge and affrighted. "Oh, Daddy! Daddy, it was her! 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 Oh, Daddy!" He slammed into Jack's arms like a blunt arrow, making Jack rock on his feet. Danny clutched at him furiously, at first seeming to pummel him like a fighter, then clutching his belt and sobbing against his shirt. Jack could feel his son's face, hot and working against his belly. Daddy, it was her. Jack looked slowly up into Wendy's face. His eyes were like small silver coins. Wendy? Voice soft, nearly purring. Wendy, what did you do to him? Wendy stared back at him in stunned disbelief, her face pallid. She shook her head.
Oh, Jack, you must know.
Outside, it had begun to snow again. 29. Kitchen Talk. Jack carried Danny into the kitchen. The boy was still sobbing wildly, refusing to look up from Jack's chest. In the kitchen, he gave Danny back to Wendy, who still seemed stunned and disbelieving.
Jack, I don't know what he's talking about. Please, you must believe that.
I do believe it, he said, although he had to admit to himself that it gave him a certain amount of pleasure to see the shoe switch to the other foot with such dazzling, unexpected speed. But his anger at Wendy had been only a passing gut twitch. In his heart, he knew Wendy would pour a can of gasoline over herself and strike a match before harming Danny. The large tea kettle was on the back burner, poking along on low heat. Jack dropped a tea bag into his own large ceramic cup and poured hot water halfway.
Got cooking sherry, don't you? He asked Wendy.
What?
Oh, sure, two or three bottles of it.
Which cupboard? She pointed, and Jack took one of the bottles down. He poured a hefty dollop into the teacup, put the sherry back, and filled the last quarter of the cup with milk. Then he added 3 tablespoons of sugar and stirred. He brought it to Danny, whose sobs had tapered off to snifflings and hitchings, but he was trembling all over, and his eyes were wide and starry.
Want you to drink this, Doc, Jack said. It's going to taste frigging awful, but it'll make you feel better. Can you drink it for your daddy?
Danny nodded that he could, and took the cup. He drank a little, grimaced, and looked questioningly at Jack. Jack nodded, and Danny drank again. Wendy felt the familiar twist of jealousy somewhere in her middle, knowing the boy would not have drunk it for her. On the heels of that came an uncomfortable, even startling thought. Had she wanted to think Jack was to blame? Was she that jealous? It was the way her mother would have thought. That was the really horrible thing. She could remember a Sunday when her dad had taken her to the park, and she had toppled from the second tier of the jungle gym, cutting both knees. When her father brought her home, her mother had shrieked at him.
What did you do? Why weren't you watching her? What kind of father are you?
She hounded him to his grave. By the time he divorced her, it was too late. She had never even given Jack the benefit of the doubt, not the smallest. Wendy felt her face burn, yet knew with a kind of helpless finality that if the whole thing were to be played over again, she would do and think the same way. She carried part of her mother with her always, for good or bad.
Jack, she began,
not sure if she meant to apologize or justify. Either she knew would be useless.
Not now, he said.
It took Danny 15 minutes to drink half of the big cup's contents, and by that time he had calmed visibly. The shakes were almost gone. Jack put his hand solemnly on his son's shoulders.
Danny, do you think you can tell us exactly what happened to you? It's very important.
Danny looked from Jack to Wendy, then back again. In the silent pause, their setting and situation made themselves known. The whoop of the wind outside, driving fresh snow down from the northwest, the creaking and groaning of the old hotel as it settled into another storm. The fact of their disconnect came to Wendy with unexpected force, as it sometimes did, like a blow under the heart.
I want to tell you everything, Danny said. I wish I had before.
He picked up the cup and held it, as if comforted by the warmth.
Why didn't you, son? Jack brushed Danny's sweaty, tumbled hair back gently from his brow.
Because Uncle Al got you the job, and I couldn't figure out how it was good for you here and bad for you here at the same time. It was...
He looked at them for help. He did not have the necessary word.
A dilemma?
Wendy asked gently.
When neither choice seems any good?
Yes, that. He nodded, relieved. Wendy said,
The day that you trimmed the hedges, Danny and I had a talk in the truck. The day the first real snow came, remember?
Jack nodded. The day he had trimmed the hedges was very clear in his mind.
Wendy sighed. I guess we didn't talk enough, did we, Doc?
Danny, the picture of woe, shook his head.
Exactly what did you talk about? Jack asked. I'm not sure how much I like my wife and son
discussing how much they love you.
Whatever it was, I don't understand it. I feel like I came into a movie just after the intermission.
We were discussing you, Wendy said quietly. And maybe we didn't say it all in words, but we both knew. Me because I'm your wife, and Danny because he just understands things.
Jack was silent.
Danny said it just right. The place seemed good for you. You were away from all the pressures that made you so unhappy at Stovington. You were your own boss, working with your hands so you could save your brain, all of your brain, for your evening's writing. Then, I don't know just when, the place began to seem bad for you. Spending all that time down in the cellar, sifting through those old papers, all that old history, talking in your sleep.
In my sleep? Jack asked. His face wore a cautious, startled expression. I talk in my sleep?
Most of it's slurry. Once I got up to use the bathroom and you were saying, to hell with it, bring in the slots at least, no one will know, no one will ever know. Another time you woke me right up, practically yelling, unmask, unmask, unmask.
Jesus Christ, he said, and rubbed a hand over his face. He looked ill.
All your old drinking habits, too? Chewing Excedrin, wiping your mouth all the time, cranky in the morning? And you haven't been able to finish the play yet, have you?
No, not yet, but it's only a matter of time. I've been thinking about something else, a new project.
This hotel. The project Al Shockley called you about, the one he wanted you to drop.
How do you know about that? Jack barked. Were you listening in?
You... No, she said. I couldn't have listened in if I wanted to, and you'd know that if you were thinking straight. Danny and I were downstairs that night. The switchboard is shut down. Our phone upstairs was the only one in the hotel that was working because it's patched directly into the outside line. You told me so yourself.
Then how could you know what Al told me?
Danny told me. Danny knew. The same way he sometimes knows when things are misplaced or when people are thinking about divorce.
The doctor said...
She shook her head impatiently. The doctor was full of shit and we both know it. We've known it all the time. Remember when Danny said he wanted to see the fire trucks? That was no hunch. He was just a baby. He knows things. And now I'm afraid.
She looked at the bruises on Danny's neck.
Did you really know Uncle Al had called me, Danny?
Danny nodded.
He was really mad, Daddy, because you called Mr. Ullman and Mr. Ullman called him. Uncle Al didn't want you to write anything about the hotel.
Jesus, Jack said again. The bruises, Danny. Who tried to strangle you?
Danny's face went dark.
Her, he said.
The woman in that room, in 217. The dead lady.
His lips began to tremble again, and he seized the teacup and drank. Jack and Wendy exchanged a scared look over his bowed head.
Do you know anything about this?
He asked her.
She shook her head.
Not about this, no.
Danny?
He raised the boy's frightened face.
Try, son. We're right here.
I knew it was bad here, Danny said in a low voice, ever since we were in Boulder, because Tony gave me dreams about it.
What dreams?
I can't remember everything. He showed me the overlook at night, with a skull and crossbones on the front. And there was pounding, something, I don't remember what, chasing after me, a monster. Tony showed me about Redrum.
What's that, Doc?
Wendy asked.
He shook his head.
I don't know.
Rum like yo-ho-ho in a bottle of rum? Jack asked.
Danny shook his head again.
I don't know. Then we got here and Mr. Halloran talked to me in his car, because he has the shine too.
Shine?
It's...
Danny made a sweeping, all-encompassing gesture with his hands.
It's being able to understand things, to know things. Sometimes you see things. Like me knowing Uncle Al called. And Mr. Halloran knowing you call me Doc. Mr. Halloran, he was peeling potatoes in the army when he knew his brother got killed in a train crash. And when he called home, it was true.
Holy God, Jack whispered. You're not making this up, are you, Dan? Danny shook his head violently.
No, I swear to God.
Then with a touch of pride, he added,
Mr. Halloran said I had the best shine of anyone he ever met. We could talk back and forth to each other without hardly opening our mouths.
His parents looked at each other again, frankly stunned.
Mr. Halloran got me alone because he was worried, Danny went on. He said this was a bad place for people who shine. He said he'd seen things. I saw something, too, right after I talked to him, when Mr. Ullman was taking us around.
What was it? Jack asked.
In the presidential suite, on the wall by the door going into the bedroom. A whole lot of blood and some other stuff. Gushy stuff. I think that the gushy stuff must have been brains.
Oh, my God, Jack said. Wendy was now very pale, her lips nearly gray. This place, Jack said. Some pretty bad types owned it a while back. Organization people from Las Vegas.
Crooks?
Danny asked. Yeah, crooks. He looked at Wendy. In 1966, a big-time hood named Vito Gianelli got killed up there, along with his two bodyguards. There was a picture in the newspaper. Danny just described the picture.
Mr. Halloran said he saw some other stuff, Danny told him. Once about the playground, and once it was something bad in that room, 217. A maid saw it and lost her job because she talked about it. So Mr. Halloran went up and he saw it too, but he didn't talk about it because he didn't want to lose his job. Except he told me never to go in there. But I did. Because I believed him when he said the things you saw here couldn't hurt you.
This last was nearly whispered, in a low, husky voice, and Danny touched the puffed circle of bruises on his neck. What about the playground? Jack asked in a strange, casual voice.
I don't know. The playground, he said. And the hedge animals.
Jack jumped a little, and Wendy looked at him curiously.
Have you seen anything down there, Jack?
No, he said. Nothing. Danny was looking at him.
Nothing,
he said again, more calmly. And that was true. He had been the victim of an hallucination, and that was all.
Danny, we have to hear about the woman, Wendy said gently.
So Danny told them, but his words came in cyclic bursts, sometimes almost verging on incomprehensible garble in his hurry to spit it out and be free of it. He pushed tighter and tighter against his mother's breasts as he talked.
I went in, he said. I stole the passkey and went in. It was like I couldn't help myself. I had to know. And she, the lady, was in the tub. She was dead, all swelled up. She was didn't have no clothes on.
He looked miserably at his mother.
And she started to get up, and she wanted me. I know she did, because I could feel it. She wasn't even thinking, not the way you and Daddy think. It was black. It was hurt think, like the wasps that night in my room, only wanting to hurt, like the wasps.
He swallowed, and there was silence for a moment, all quiet while the image of the wasps sank into them.
So I ran, Danny said. I ran, but the door was closed. I left it open, but it was closed. I didn't think about just opening it again and running out. I was scared, so I leaned against the door and closed my eyes and thought of how Mr. Halloran said the things here were just like pictures in a book, and if I kept saying to myself, you're not there, go away, you're not there, she would go away. But it didn't work.
His voice began to rise hysterically.
She grabbed me, turned me around. I could see her eyes, how her eyes were, and she started to choke me. I could smell her. I could smell how dead she was.
Stop now, shh. Wendy said, alarmed. Stop, Danny. It's all right. She was getting ready to go into her croon again. The Wendy Torrance all-purpose croon. Pat pending. Let him finish, Jack said curtly.
There isn't any more, Danny said. I passed out, either because she was choking me or just because I was scared. When I came to, I was dreaming you and Mommy were fighting over me, and you wanted to do the bad thing again, Daddy. Then I knew it wasn't a dream at all, and I was awake, and I wet my pants like a baby.
His head fell back against Wendy's sweater, and he began to cry with horrible weakness, his hands lying limp and spent in his lap. Jack got up. Take care of him.
What are you going to do?
Her face was full of dread. I'm going up to that room. What did you think I was going to do? Have coffee?
No! Don't, Jack, please don't!
Wendy, if there's someone else in the hotel, we have to know.
Don't you dare leave us alone!
She shrieked at him. Spittle flew from her lips with the force of her cry. Jack said, Wendy, that's a remarkable imitation of your mom. She burst into tears then, unable to cover her face because Danny was on her lap. I'm sorry, Jack said, but I have to, you know. I'm the goddamn caretaker. It's what I'm paid for. She only cried harder, and he left her that way, going out of the kitchen, rubbing his mouth with his handkerchief as the door swung shut behind him.
Don't worry, Mommy, Danny said. He'll be all right. He doesn't shine. Nothing here can hurt him.
Through her tears, she said, No, I don't believe that. 30. 217, Revisited. He took the elevator up, and it was strange, because none of them had used the elevator since they moved in. He threw the brass handle over, and it wheezed vibratoriously up the shaft, the brass grate rattling madly. Wendy had a true claustrophobe's horror of the elevator, he knew. She envisioned the three of them trapped in it between floors while the winter storms raged outside. She could see them growing thinner and weaker, starving to death, or perhaps dining on each other, the way those rugby players had. He remembered a bumper sticker he had seen in Boulder, "Rugby players eat their own dead." He could think of others. "You are what you eat." Or menu items. "Welcome to the Overlook Dining Room, pride of the Rockies. Eat in splendor at the roof of the world. Human haunch, broiled over matches. La spécialité de la maison." The contemptuous smile flicked over his features again. As the number 2 rose on the shaft wall, he threw the brass handle back to the home position and the elevator car creaked to a stop. He took his Excedrin from his pocket, shook 3 of them into his hand, and opened the elevator door. Nothing in the Overlook frightened him. He felt that he and it were simpatico. He walked up the hall, flipping his Excedrin into his mouth and chewing them one by one. He rounded the corner into the short corridor off the main hall. The door to room 217 was ajar, and the passkey hung from the lock on its white paddle. He frowned, feeling a wave of irritation and even real anger. Whatever had come of it, the boy had been trespassing. He had been told, and told bluntly, that certain areas of the hotel were off-limits, the equipment shed, the basement, and all of the guest rooms. He would talk to Danny about that just as soon as the boy was over his fright. He would talk to him reasonably, but sternly. There were plenty of fathers who would have done more than just talk. They would have administered a good shaking, and perhaps that was what Danny needed. If the boy had gotten a scare, wasn't that at least his just deserts? He walked down to the door, removed the passkey, dropped it into his pocket, and stepped inside. The overhead light was on. He glanced at the bed, saw it was not rumpled, and then walked directly across to the bathroom door. A curious certainty had grown in him. Although Watson had mentioned no names or room numbers, Jack felt sure that this was the room the lawyer's wife and her stud had shared, that this was the bathroom where she had been found dead, full of barbiturates and Colorado Lounge booze. He pushed the mirror-backed bathroom door open and stepped through. The light in here was off. He turned it on and observed the long Pullman car room, furnished in the distinctive early 1900s remodeled in the 20s style that seemed common to all Overlook bathrooms, except for the ones on the third floor. Those were properly Byzantine, as befitted the royalty, politicians, movie stars, and capos who had stayed there over the years. The shower curtain, a pallid pastel pink, was drawn protectively around the long, claw-footed tub. Nevertheless, they did move. And for the first time he felt his new sense of sureness, almost cockiness, that had come over him when Danny ran to him shouting, it was her," deserting him. A chilled finger pressed gently against the base of his spine, cooling him off 10 degrees. It was joined by others, and they suddenly rippled all the way up his back to his medulla oblongata, playing his spine like a jungle instrument. His anger at Danny evaporated, and as he stepped forward and pushed the shower curtain back, his mouth was dry, and he felt only sympathy for his son and terror for himself. The tub was dry and empty. Relief and irritation vented in a sudden "pah" sound that escaped his compressed lips like a very small explosive. The tub had been scrubbed clean at the end of the season. Except for the rust stain under the twin faucets, it sparkled. There was a faint but definable smell of cleanser, the kind that can irritate your nose with the smell of its own righteousness for weeks, even months, after it has been used. He bent down and ran his fingertips along the bottom of the tub, dry as a bone, not even a hint of moisture. The boy had been either hallucinating or outright lying. He felt angry again. That was when the bath mat on the floor caught his attention. He frowned down at it. What was a bath mat doing in here? It should be down in the linen cupboard at the end of the wing, with the rest of the sheets and towels and pillow slips. All the linen was supposed to be there. Not even the beds were really made up in these guest rooms. The mattresses had been zipped into clear plastic and then covered with bedspreads. He supposed Danny might have gone down and gotten it. The passkey would open the linen cupboard. But why? He brushed the tips of his fingers back and forth across it. The bath mat was bone dry. He went back to the bathroom door and stood in it. Everything was all right. The boy had been dreaming. There was not a thing out of place. It was a little puzzling about the bath mat, granted, but the logical explanation was that some chambermaid, hurrying like mad on the last day of the season, had just forgotten to pick it up. Other than that, everything was... His nostrils flared a little. Disinfectant, that self-righteous smell, cleaner than thou. And soap? Surely not. But once the smell had been identified, it was too clear to dismiss. Soap. And not one of those postcard-size bars of ivory they provide you with in hotels and motels, either. This scent was light and perfumed, a lady's soap. It had a pink sort of smell. Camay or Loilla, the brand that Wendy had always used in Sovington. It's nothing. It's your imagination. Yes. Like the hedges, nevertheless, they did move. They did not move. He crossed jerkily to the door which gave on the hall, feeling the irregular thump of a headache beginning at his temples. Too much had happened today, too much by far. He wouldn't spank the boy or shake him, just talk to him. But by God, he wasn't going to add room 217 to his problems. Not on the basis of a dry bath mat and a faint smell of Loilla soap. There was a sudden rattling, metallic sound behind him. It came just as his hand closed around the doorknob, and an observer might have thought the brushed steel of the knob carried an electric charge. He jerked convulsively, eyes widening, other facial features drawing in, grimacing. Then he had control of himself, a little anyway, and he let go of the doorknob and turned carefully around. His joints creaked. He began to walk back to the bathroom door, step by leaden step. The shower curtain, which he had pushed back to look into the tub, was now drawn. The metallic rattle, which had sounded to him like a stir of bones in a crypt, had been the curtain rings on the overhead bar. Jack stared at the curtain. His face felt as if it had been heavily waxed, all dead skin on the outside, live, hot rivulets of fear on the inside, the way he had felt on the playground. There was something behind the pink plastic shower curtain. There was something in the tub. He could see it, ill-defined and obscure through the plastic, a nearly amorphous shape. It could have been anything. A trick of the light. The shadow of the shower attachment. A woman long dead and reclining in her bath, a bar of Loilla in one stiffening hand as she waited patiently for whatever lover might come. Jack told himself to step forward boldly and rake the shower curtain back, to expose whatever might be there. Instead, he turned with jerky marionette strides, his heart whamming frightfully in his chest, and went back into the bed sitting room. The door to the hall was shut. He stared at it for a long, immobile second. He could taste his terror now. It was in the back of his throat, like a taste of gone-over cherries. He walked to the door with that same jerky stride and forced his fingers to curl around the knob. It won't open. But it did. He turned off the light with a fumbling gesture, stepped out into the hall, and pulled the door shut without looking back. From inside, he seemed to hear an odd, wet thumping sound, far off, dim, as if something had just scrambled belatedly out of the tub, as if to greet a caller, as if it had realized the caller was leaving before the social amenities had been completed, and so it was now rushing to the door, all purple and grinning, to invite the caller back inside, perhaps forever. Footsteps approaching the door, or only the heartbeat in his ears. He fumbled at the passkey. It seemed sludgy, unwilling to turn in the lock. He attacked the passkey. The tumbler suddenly fell, and he stepped back against the corridor's far wall, a little groan of relief escaping him. He closed his eyes, and all the old phrases began to parade through his mind. It seemed there must be hundreds of them. Cracking up, not playing with a full deck, lost your marbles, guy just went Looney Tunes, he went up and over the high side, went bananas, lost his football, crackers, nuts, half a sea bag, all meaning the same thing. Losing your mind. No, he whimpered, hardly aware that he had been reduced to this, whimpering with his eyes shut like a child. Oh no, God. Please. God, no. But below the tumble of his chaotic thoughts, below the trip hammer beat of his heart, he could hear the soft and futile sound of the doorknob being turned to and fro as something locked in tried helplessly to get out, something that wanted to meet him, something that would like to be introduced to his family as the storm shrieked around them and white daylight became black night. If he opened his eyes and saw that doorknob moving, he would go mad. So he kept them shut. And after an unknowable time, there was stillness. Jack forced himself to open his eyes, half convinced that when he did, she would be standing before him. But the hall was empty. He felt watched just the same. He looked at the peephole in the center of the door and wondered what would happen if he approached it, stared into it. What would he be eyeball to eyeball with? His feet were moving, "Feet, don't fail me now," before he realized it. He turned them away from the door and walked down to the main hall, his feet whispering on the blue-black jungle carpet. He stopped halfway to the stairs and looked at the fire extinguisher. He thought that the folds of canvas were arranged in a slightly different manner, and he was quite sure that the brass nozzle had been pointing toward the elevator when he came up the hall. Now it was pointing the other way.
"I didn't see that at all,"
Jack Torrance said, quite clearly. His face was white and haggard, and his mouth kept trying to grin. But he didn't take the elevator back down. It was too much like an open mouth, too much by half. He took the stairs. 31. The Verdict. He stepped into the kitchen and looked at them, bouncing the passkey a few inches up off his left hand, making the chain on the white metal tongue jingle, then catching it again. Danny was pallid and worn out. Wendy had been crying, he saw. Her eyes were red and darkly circled. He felt a sudden burst of gladness at this. He wasn't suffering alone, that was sure. They looked at him without speaking.
"Nothing there,"
he said, astounded by the heartiness of his voice.
"Not a thing."
He bounced the passkey up and down, smiling reassuringly at them, watching the relief spread over their faces, and thought he had never in his life wanted a drink so badly as he did right now. 32. The Bedroom. Late that afternoon, Jack got a cot from the first-floor storage room and put it in the corner of their bedroom. Wendy had expected that the boy would be half the night getting to sleep, but Danny was nodding before the Waltons was half over, and 15 minutes after they had tucked him in, he was far down in sleep, moveless, one hand tucked under his cheek. Wendy sat watching him, holding her place in a fat paperback copy of Cashel Mara with one finger. Jack sat at his desk, looking at his play.
"Oh, shit," Jack said.
Wendy looked up from her contemplation of Danny.
"What?"
"Nothing." He looked down at the play with smoldering ill temper. How could he have thought it was good? It was puerile. It had been done 1,000 times. Worse, he had no idea how to finish it. Once it had seemed simple enough. Denker, in a fit of rage, seizes the poker from beside the fireplace and beats Saintly Gary to death. Then, standing spread-legged over the body, the bloody poker in one hand, he screams at the audience, "It's here somewhere, and I will find it!" Then, as the lights dim and the curtain is slowly drawn, the audience sees Gary's body face down on the forestage as Denker strides to the upstage bookcase and feverishly begins pulling books from the shelves, looking at them, throwing them aside. He had thought it was something old enough to be new, a play whose novelty alone might be enough to see it through a successful Broadway run, a tragedy in 5 acts. But in addition to his sudden diversion of interest to the Overlook's history, something else had happened. He had developed opposing feelings about his characters. This was something quite new. Ordinarily, he liked all of his characters, the good and the bad. He was glad he did. It allowed him to try to see all of their sides and understand their motivations more clearly. His favorite story, sold to a small southern Maine magazine called Contraband for copies, had been a piece called "The Monkey is Here, Paul DeLong." It had been about a child molester about to commit suicide in his furnished room. The child molester's name had been Paul DeLong, Monkey to his friends. Jack had liked Monkey very much. He sympathized with Monkey's bizarre needs, knowing that Monkey was not the only one to blame for the 3 rape murders in his past. There had been bad parents, the father a beater, as his own father had been, the mother a limp and silent dishrag, as his mother had been. A homosexual experience in grammar school, public humiliation, worse experiences in high school and college. He had been arrested and sent to an institution after exposing himself to a pair of little girls getting off a school bus. Worst of all, he had been dismissed from the institution,
let back out onto the streets because the man in charge had decided he was all right. This man's name had been Grimmer. Grimmer had known that Monkey DeLong was exhibiting deviant symptoms, but he had written the good, hopeful report and had let him go anyway. Jack liked and sympathized with Grimmer, too. Grimmer had to run an understaffed and underfunded institution and try to keep the whole thing together with spit, baling wire, and nickel-and-dime appropriations from a state legislature who had to go back and face the voters. Grimmer knew that Monkey could interact with other people, that he did not soil his pants or try to stab his fellow inmates with the scissors. He did not think he was Napoleon. The staff psychiatrist in charge of Monkey's case thought there was a better-than-even chance that Monkey could make it on the street, and they both knew that the longer a man is in an institution, the more he comes to need that closed environment, like a junkie with his smack. And meanwhile, people were knocking down the doors. Paranoids, schizoids, cycloids, semi-catatonics, men who claimed to have gone to heaven in flying saucers, women who had burned their children's sex organs off with Bic lighters, alcoholics, pyromaniacs, kleptomaniacs, manic depressives, suicidals. Tough old world, baby. If you're not bolted together tightly, you're gonna shake, rattle, and roll before you turn 30. Jack could sympathize with Grimmer's problem. He could sympathize with the parents of the murder victims, with the murdered children themselves, of course, and with Monkey DeLong. Let the reader lay blame. In those days, he hadn't wanted to judge. The cloak of the moralist sat badly on his shoulders. He had started the little school in the same optimistic vein, but lately, he had begun to choose up sides, and worse still, he had come to loathe his hero, Gary Benson. Originally conceived as a bright boy more cursed with money than blessed with it, a boy who wanted more than anything to compile a good record so he could go to a good university because he had earned admission and not because his father had pulled strings, he had become to Jack a kind of simpering goody-two-shoes, a postulant before the altar of knowledge rather than a sincere acolyte, an outward paragon of Boy Scout virtues, inwardly cynical, filled not with real brilliance as he had first been conceived, but only with sly animal cunning. All through the play he unfailingly addressed Denker as Sir, just as Jack had taught his own son to address those older and those in authority as Sir. He thought that Danny used the word quite sincerely, and Gary Benson, as originally conceived, had too. But as he had begun Act 5, it had come more and more strongly to him that Gary was using the word satirically, outwardly straight-faced, while the Gary Benson inside was mugging and leering at Denker. Denker, who had never had any of the things Gary had. Denker, who had had to work all his life just to become head of a single little school. Who was now faced with ruin over this handsome, innocent-seeming rich boy who had cheated on his final composition and had then cunningly covered his tracks. Jack had seen Denker the teacher as not much different from the strutting South American Little Caesars in their banana kingdoms, standing dissidents up against the wall of the handiest squash or handball court, a super zealot in a comparatively small puddle, a man whose every whim becomes a crusade. In the beginning, he had wanted to use his play as a microcosm to say something about the abuse of power. Now he tended more and more to see Denker as a Mr. Chips figure, and the tragedy was not the intellectual racking of Gary Benson, but rather the destruction of a kindly old teacher and headmaster, unable to see through the cynical wiles of this monster masquerading as a boy. He hadn't been able to finish the play. Now he sat, looking down at it, scowling, wondering if there was any way he could salvage the situation. He didn't really think there was. He had begun with one play, and it had somehow turned into another, presto changeo. Well, what the hell? Either way it had been done before. Either way it was a load of shit. And why was he driving himself crazy about it tonight anyway? After the day just gone by, it was no wonder he couldn't think straight. Get him down. He looked up, trying to blink the cobwebs away. Huh? I said, how are we going to get him down? We've got to get him out of here, Jack. For a moment his wits were so scattered that he wasn't even sure what she was talking about. Then he realized, and uttered a short, barking laugh. You say that as if it were so easy.
I didn't mean...
No problem, Wendy. I'll just change clothes in that telephone booth down in the lobby and fly him to Denver on my back. Superman Jack Torrance, they called me in my salad days. Her face registered slow hurt.
I understand the problem, Jack. The radio is broken, the snow. But you have to understand Danny's problem. My God, don't you? He was nearly catatonic, Jack. What if he hadn't come out of that?
But he did, Jack said, a trifle shortly. He had been frightened at Danny's blank-eyed, slack-faced state, too. Of course he had, at first. But the more he thought about it, the more he wondered if it hadn't been a piece of play-acting put on to escape his punishment. He had, after all, been trespassing.
All the same, she said.
She came to him and sat on the end of the bed by his desk. Her face was both surprised and worried.
Jack, the bruises on his neck. Something got at him, and I want him away from it.
Don't shout, he said. My head aches, Wendy. I'm as worried about this as you are, so please, don't shout.
All right, she said, lowering her voice. I won't shout, but I don't understand you, Jack. Someone is in here with us, and not a very nice someone either. We have to get down to Sidewinder, not just Danny, but all of us, quickly. And you're sitting there reading your play.
We have to get down. We have to get down. You keep saying that. You must think I really am Superman.
I think you're my husband, she said softly, and looked down at her hands.
His temper flared. He slammed the play script down, knocking the edges of the pile out of true again, and crumpling the sheets on the bottom. It's time you got some of the home truths into you, Wendy. You don't seem to have internalized them, as the sociologists say. They're knocking around up in your head like a bunch of loose cue balls. You need to shoot them into the pockets. You need to understand that we are snowed in.
Danny had suddenly become active in his bed. Still sleeping, he had begun to twist and turn, the way he always did when we fought, Wendy thought dismally, and we're doing it again.
Don't wake him up, Jack, please.
He glanced over at Danny, and some of the flush went out of his cheeks. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I sounded mad, Wendy. It's not really for you, but I broke the radio. If it's anybody's fault, it's mine. That was our big link to the outside. Ollie Ollie in for free. Please come get us, Mr. Ranger. We can't stay out this late.
Don't,
she said, and put a hand on his shoulder. He leaned his head against it. She brushed his hair with her other hand.
I guess you've got a right after what I accused you of. Sometimes I am like my mother. I can be a bitch. But you have to understand that some things are hard to get over. You have to understand that.
Do you mean his arm? His lips had thinned.
Yes,
Wendy said, and then she rushed on.
But it's not just you. I worry when he goes out to play. I worry about him wanting a two-wheeler next year, even one with training wheels. I worry about his teeth and his eyesight and about this thing, what he calls his shine. I worry. Because he's little and he seems very fragile and because something in this hotel seems to want him. And it will go through us to get him, if it has to. That's why we must get him out, Jack. I know that. I feel that. We must get him out.
Her hand had tightened painfully on his shoulder in her agitation, but he didn't move away. One hand found the firm weight of her left breast, and he began to stroke it through her shirt.
Wendy, he said, and stopped.
She waited for him to rearrange whatever he had to say. His strong hand on her breast felt good, soothing. I could maybe snowshoe him down. He could walk part of the way himself, but I would mostly have to carry him. It would mean camping out one, two, maybe three nights. That would mean building a travoy to carry supplies and bedrolls on. We have the AM/FM radio, so we could pick a day when the weather forecast called for a three-day spell of good weather. But if the forecast was wrong, he finished, his voice soft and measured. I think we might die. Her face had paled. It looked shiny, almost ghostly. He continued to stroke her breast, rubbing the ball of his thumb gently over the nipple. She made a soft sound. From his words or in reaction to his gentle pressure on her breast, he couldn't tell. He raised his hand slightly and undid the top button of her shirt. Wendy shifted her legs slightly. All at once her jeans seemed too tight. Slightly irritating in a pleasant sort of way. It would mean leaving you alone because you can't snowshoe worth beans. It would be maybe 3 days of not knowing. Would you want that? His hand dropped to the second button, slipped it, and the beginning of her cleavage was exposed.
No,
she said in a voice that was slightly thick. She glanced over at Danny. He had stopped twisting and turning. His thumb had crept back into his mouth, so that was all right. But Jack was leaving something out of the picture. It was too bleak.
There was something else. What?
If we stay put, Jack said, unbuttoning the third and fourth buttons with that same deliberate slowness. A ranger from the park or a game warden is going to poke in here just to find out how we're doing.